Welcome to the ASHP Official Podcast, your guide to issues related to medication use, public health, and the profession of pharmacy.
Thank you for joining us for the Wellbeing and Resiliency in Pharmacy Podcast. This podcast is a forum where you can listen in as members and partners share successful strategies on well-being and resiliency in their personal and professional lives. My name is Anna Legger-Dopp, Senior Director of Government Relations at the American Society of Health System Pharmacists, and I will be your host of today's episode. With me today are Dr. John Howard, Director of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH, as many of you know, and Dr. Stephanie Simmons, Chief Medical Officer to the Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Howard and Dr. Simmons, or John and Steph. Let's get started talking about today's topic, pharmacist occupational burnout and well-being, and the newly released Impact Well-Being Guide. As we get started, could you each briefly share a bit more about your roles and how you're working to address occupational burnout and improve well-being of the health workforce, including pharmacists?
Sure, I'll start. Thanks, Anna. John Howard here from the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH, as Anna said. I'm also the administrator of the World Trade Center Health Program in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And NIOSH is not new to this area of worker safety and health. We're actually celebrating our 54th year. And we have, during those 54 years, provided guidance and recommendations and programs to support employers, especially healthcare system employers in the healthcare industry and healthcare workers, also unions and healthcare worker advocates and other representatives of the healthcare workforce to create safer and healthier workplaces.
Anna, it's great to join you today. Steph Simmons, I am the Chief Medical Officer for the Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation. I'm a board-certified emergency medicine physician and a healthcare leader. At the foundation, we accelerate the pace of positive change in professional well-being by advancing solutions, advocating for positive policies for the healthcare workforce, and making connections that put healthcare workers' well-being first. Over the past year and a half, I have worked with NIOSH to help author the Impact Wellbeing Guide, which we'll talk a little bit about today. And I'm thrilled that this resource is now publicly available. As part of its development, I facilitated a pilot of the guide where we partnered with Common Spirit Health to test it in real-world scenario and for utility and to test the content in 6 hospitals. So I'm excited to share more about these new tools and my hope that they can help hospital leaders and organizations make real needed changes.
We are excited to hear more about the guide from both of you. In previous episodes of this podcast, we've discussed some of the drivers of occupational burnout and various initiatives to address it. Can you share a bit more about those as well as priorities to address? We'll start with John.
Sure. So let me start a little bit of history and then build up towards what Steph just referred to as our well-being guide. Before the pandemic, the wide scope of healthcare workers, including pharmacists, faced really challenging workplace conditions that led to depression, anxiety, and ultimately to burnout in their profession. Clearly, the stressors were long work hours, hazardous exposures, stressful work, and high administrative burdens in the healthcare industry is extremely common. Healthcare workers are very dedicated workers to their patients and often tend to take on more than they can actually accomplish stress-wise. And we've been able to show in various studies that fact. And in fact, in October, we at NIOSH and CDC released a vital signs report, which compared data in these stressors from 2018 before the pandemic to 2022 during the pandemic. And we found that healthcare workers' burnout and the symptoms of mental health stressors were at higher levels than before the pandemic. So clearly, the pandemic exacerbated a problem that was already there. And the report also highlighted the factors that can foster a more supportive work environment and promote well-being. So not only did this report point out the problem, but it also pointed to how we can fix the problem and provide solutions. This, the kind of solutions that we were able to discern from this report is giving workers the opportunity to participate. It's extremely important to participate in workplace decisions, because oftentimes in a healthcare workplace, the workers are sort of given instructions, but the idea is to involve them in how to craft those instructions, what needs to be done. Because if you do that, you can build trust between the management structure and the healthcare worker structure. And that's really, really critical. And we also learned that training supervisors to be very proactive, to be very helpful to workers, to be attuned to their needs is extremely important. So all of the findings that we've been able to look at from our research has really propelled us to the space where we launched basically a brand new initiative for healthcare workers, especially in the hospital setting, called Impact Wellbeing. We launched it last fall. It really is the first federal government campaign to help hospital leaders improve the well-being of our workforce in the nation's hospitals, no matter what your job is as a healthcare worker. So at the core, the campaign encourages hospital leaders to take a more holistic approach to well-being to support their workforce, which includes addressing workplace issues that contribute to burnout. And clearly, pharmacists are at the front end, frontline workers, nurses, doctors, pharmacists, respiratory therapists, all of those categories of workers, emergency room workers, et cetera. They're really at the heart of our new guide, our Impact Wellbeing Guide, because our guide, as Steph referred to just now, is a guide to taking action. We are just so thrilled to be in collaboration with the Dr. Laura Breen Heroes Foundation. They have really given us so much in the way of experience, trust, cultural competence, so to speak, to be able to reach the right audience. So the guide essentially provides hospital leaders with free of charge, evidence-informed from our studies that we've been able to do, plus the foundation and academic studies. We've provided them all to create steps to prevent worker burnout and sustain their well-being.
John, I couldn't agree with you more. As you were going through the factors that have led to this crisis of mental health and of occupational burnout in healthcare workers, work environment, culture, and leadership are all critical factors in that. There's also barriers that exist for healthcare workers in seeking help that are different than other workers. So research that asks healthcare workers, why don't you get mental health care, right? Even when it is available to you, it really shows that the fear of judgment and professional repercussions associated with talking about and seeking behavioral health care is very high in healthcare workers, and in some cases for good reason. So when they seek care, healthcare workers, when they access mental health support or counseling at hospitals where they work, they can be treated by their colleagues. And this can lead to a perceived loss of confidentiality and increased sense of individual or social stigma. So in addition, licensed healthcare workers may be asked to answer questions about their diagnosis or treatment of mental health on their licensing and credentialing applications, on peer reference forms. And this can have a significant chilling effect on people's willingness to seek care. So in the guide, not only do we talk about really accessing the voice of the healthcare workforce, but also making sure that these types of questions are looked at and changed to positively impact the healthcare workforce's willingness to seek care.
As I reflect on what both of you just shared and the resources that have come out of your organizations from NIOSH and the Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation, what's exciting about the point that we are now, we've disseminated what you've shared to our members before, but right now, the support has gone from raising awareness to taking action. That's an exciting place to be. As we think about this work and as well-being moves beyond individual resilience efforts and more towards system level changes, why is it important that hospitals take a more holistic approach to well-being, and what roles do both leaders and workers play in these efforts?
I'm an ER doc, and you can take the girl out of the ER, but you can't take the ER out of the girl, right? So when I think about occupational burnout, I think of a bleeding wound, a wounded workforce. You need to hold pressure on a wound to slow the bleeding. And when I think of individual support, it's really holding pressure on that wound and slowing the impact of the trauma that's already occurred. But we need to also address the source of the bleeding for our healthcare workforce. So individual mental health and well-being resources are a really strong starting point, but we also need to address workplace policies. And that's where we're going to strengthen professional well-being, not only professional well-being, but patient outcomes and the costs associated with staff turnover and lost revenue and threats to our hospitals and health systems' long-term viability. So this is about the health of the healthcare worker. And let's be clear, that would be enough. And it's also about the health of our healthcare system writ large as well. So based on some key insights when we were developing the campaign, we learned that healthcare workers really want their leaders to help develop local solutions specific to their needs and to act, to implement systemic changes that reduce burnout and really enable some of those help-seeking behaviors in staff. And so what we're trying to do, as you said, is to move beyond only individual support and to augment that with the type of systems change that's really going to alter the way that the workforce experiences work.
Yeah, Steph, I just want to really punctuate that a bit and contrast the issue of individual resilience to organizational change, because there's this common belief, and it's not just in the healthcare industry, you see this in other very stressful industries where you all need to have more individual resilience. We're going to sign you up for a course of how to create more individual resilience. But the problem is that there's only so much resilience that you can do. And because there's an infinite amount of stress that can be applied by an external system, and you can't be infinitely resilient. No human being can be infinitely resilient. So it goes to the issue of how the organization can change, how the organization can also participate in helping individuals be more resilient by decreasing the stresses that come from the way the organization works, the system works, and all of those factors that are associated with the organization, scheduling time and lunch time and days off and double supervisors not knowing which one to adhere to and complicated issues that relate to the system. Sure. It's great to be individually resilient, but there's a limit to that. And I think that's really the major message in our guide, is that we want the organization, we want the hospital leader to be, they're in the unique position. They control the workplace. The workers don't control how work is assigned, for instance, as an example. And those system, those organizational stresses have been shown to be the major issue in burnout, because there's only so much individual resilience that workers have. So that's really the contrast that I wanted to draw. The guide is oriented to organizational changes that support worker well-being, as opposed to having more individual resilience. You guys just need to bulk up your individual resilience and everything's going to be fine. No, things are not going to be fine. The system has to be modified.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up the workplace stressors, because in my experience, the people who know what those workplace stressors are the best are the workforce themselves, right? And so while we know that the operational improvements are often made by hospital leaders, the hospital leaders need to include their healthcare workforce perspectives to be at the forefront of that work. I think It was Muhammad Ali who said, it's not the mountain ahead to climb that defeats you, it's the pebble in your shoe. And so we need to make sure that the healthcare workforce can communicate and have pathways to communicate to their leaders. What are those pebbles that are getting in the way, right, of climbing the mountain of work that is patient care and is healthcare in the healthcare system, and really making sure that those perspectives are valued in decision making?
Yeah, so that, I think that point you're making goes to the issue of my little coded messages, which is workforce participation. That truly means that you get together with managers, you as workers get together with managers and work out, okay, let's look at scheduling, let's look at workload, relationship to patient safety, et cetera. Let's sit down and work those things out. That issue, if an employer, a hospital, a leader, et cetera, understands that that value is extremely important and they actuate it, then trust comes. Then trust is the outcome of that. So I think that really is the key, is workforce participation. Once you have that in a system, then everyone can work on the problem as a collaborative, as opposed to something that floats down to you from on high.
Well, thank you, Steph and John. Now that we've set the stage for the types of solutions that are needed, can you share, let's just dig into the guide a little bit. Can you share a little bit more about the Impact Wellbeing Guide? How does this resource support the healthcare workforce? And Steph, let's start with your thoughts.
Thanks, Anna. For healthcare leaders, it can be a bit daunting to know where to start because there are areas within the entire healthcare system and how it works that could use improvement. And on any given Wednesday, when you wake up, it can feel daunting. Like, where do we start? What do we need to address these issues? And that's why we launched the new Impact Wellbeing Guide, to really provide leaders with feasible, actionable strategies to just get started and to accelerate the pace of change in their organizations. So the guide highlights six actions that build on each other to help leaders lay a foundation for a long-term commitment to their well-being efforts. These actions include conducting a review of hospital operations to understand how they support professional well-being, because sometimes the executive sponsors in charge of really moving this work forward in an organization don't know what's already underway. So really understanding what's already underway and then building a dedicated, inclusive team to support professional well-being in the organization, and really including folks that they may not have initially considered that need to be part of that committee and lend their voice to how things are working in their part of the organization. Step three, you know, removing barriers to seeking care, such as intrusive or stigmatizing mental health questions, either on credentialing applications or peer reference forms. And then also developing a suite of communication tools so that leaders can share updates with their workforce about what is happening to their benefit in the organization. In step five, it's integrating human factors into a quality improvement project in their setting. And so I think of this as taking a quality improvement project, right, from a triple aim project to a quadruple aim project by considering the impact of the work on the workforce while you're improving patient outcomes and efficiency of care. And then lastly, we, in the guide, really help and provide resources for the leader to create a 12-month plan to continue to move the professional well-being work forward in their organization beyond these initial steps into a lasting commitment. So in order to make sure that the guide was really actionable and applicable in the real world, it was tested and implemented in six Common Spirit hospitals in different regions across the U.S., and over a six-month period, we gathered feedback from the hospital leaders who were implementing the steps in the guide regarding what worked well, what needed to be refined, and to make sure that the resources we were giving them in the guide were valuable and helpful to them. Through these insights, we've seen the guide really make the implementation of the professional well-being work in their organizations more efficient. So I'm confident that it will do the same for even more organizations now that it's available for public use.
Yeah, thanks, Steph, for going through the steps and the overview of the guide. I really appreciate that. I just want to emphasize, you know, to hospital leaders, this is free, okay? You don't have to hire some expensive contractor to start out. The guide is going to give you a step-by-step instructions. That's extremely important. And I can't emphasize enough, at the outset, involve staff, create that participatory project, idea, perspective, because if you don't do that at the beginning, not going to work, because you'll have no trust, and trust is really essential. So I just want to emphasize it's a free tool, and it centralizes the work of a whole bunch of organizations. So it's not just NIOSH, it's not just Learner Green. We have recommendations from the Office of Surgeon General, from the National Academy of Medicine. This is really an idea whose time has come. It's something that we've watched the healthcare worker burnout for many years, even before the pandemic. And certainly, as I said before, the pandemic has exacerbated this. And now we actually have a guide that can get us out of this situation. So please avail yourself of it and utilize it.
Sometimes these systems level changes can seem insurmountable, and appreciate having the guide available now. But what else can hospital leaders do to make sure that these operations level improvements will really make a difference and help the workforce?
Well, from my point of view, all this can be extremely overwhelming. You know, if you're in a hospital system in which there are these issues of workplace stressors and your workforce, pharmacists that work in your pharmacy, for instance, nurses on the front line, have experienced this, and you may be losing staff, and you may be hearing complaints. The whole thing may be really complex to start off with. And that's why the guide really breaks down for someone who's willing to do this from the management side, from the leadership side, can start making changes, some small, digestible steps at the beginning. And again, as I keep emphasizing, it's a two-way communication project. It has to start together with your workforce.
When you've got a problem this big, it can feel overwhelming. And it always brings to mind the old aphorism, like, how do you eat an elephant, right? Well, one bite at a time. And so what we've tried to do here is to really break down, here are the bites, right? Take this bite first, then go to that bite. And before you know it, you're well on your way. It's also important that we measure the impact of the work within our organization. So in Action 6 of the guide, we provide a variety of different assessment tools around professional well-being to ensure that the leaders' projects and their goals are contributing to long-term progress, because we want to see the needle move in organizations. And it's important to recognize that even though the work can feel overwhelming, there are achievable changes that can be made in a short period of time. And so we need to take this on. It's critically important, not only to the well-being of our workforce, but also the well-being of all of us, because healthcare is a critical function, right? And so we need to take care of our workforce. We need to take care of each other. And this needs to be a priority for organizations and needs to have consistent executive sponsorship to keep it at the front of the work of an organization.
There's a couple of themes that I'm hearing pretty consistently from both of you, that one related to trust and then the other around co-production, co-design, involving your workforce. So let's talk about that for a little bit. Given the challenging work conditions that are being faced both by healthcare leaders and healthcare workers, let's talk about the role that trust plays in all of this, and how can leaders rebuild that relationship with their workforce to start to reaffirm trust?
That's really great that you bring that up specifically, Anna, because trust is the outcome that we want. Trust is the outcome a hospital leadership needs in order to fix problems associated with burnout. So thank you for pointing out that that's our major theme here today. It's an outcome. So what are the inputs? The inputs are all the issues that are related to organizational stress, stresses that are caused by organization and the system, okay? And then that then leads to workforce participation, which is a central cornerstone of the guide. Without that, you might as well not do it. So you've got participation. And then once you have participation, and you guys are rolling through the various steps, trust is the outcome. It's the ideal. Because we found in most of our research, as no surprise to any of the pharmacists on the line, that frequently hospital leaders, pharmacy leaders, and workers are often speaking past each other. And they have different incentives and they have different perspectives of the same situation. And it's really important to share those. Management needs to share, workforce needs to share. So you're talking about the same issue from different perspectives so you can share that information, because that leads to then ongoing collaboration between leadership and workers. And certainly then that helps build trust also. So thank you for pointing out, trust is the outcome that we're trying to get to.
I really like that, John. So it's trust is earned by being trustworthy. And one of the ways to earn that trust is really around clear, consistent communication, so that phenomenon of talking past each other can be overcome, because ultimately, everyone wants a safe, efficient workplace to care for patients, right? Where as a healthcare worker, you feel like you can make the difference in people's lives that you signed up for, that the reason you're there, right? And that you'll be safe while you're doing that. And so one way we get to this in the impact well-being guide is in the fourth action, which is really around communication. And so we outline how to develop a plan for two-way communication, not just pushing out messages, but really receiving and hearing messages from the workforce as well. Ways to get buy-in for the well-being work and to create opportunities for healthcare workers from all over the organization to give feedback. And this allows the healthcare workforce to understand that their leaders are listening. And it's important to have a formal way to understand the workplace stressors that healthcare workers face, but also a communication plan on how those stressors are being addressed. Because it's not enough to just hear what the stressors are and say, thanks for sharing them, right? You also need to then, as a leader, communicate back out, here's what we're doing to address those stressors, working with you to create a positive work environment. And that consistent communication, I'm listening, thank you for sharing, here's what we're doing about it, did it work? That constant cycle of not just the work, but the communication about the work demonstrates that trustworthiness and helps to earn that trust.
Yeah. And I think that point you're making in terms of, well, here's the problem, we're talking about it, and then here's the action plan, and then sharing how the action plan is working. Is it accomplishing what we thought it would do? Oh, no, we have to monitor it. And then we have to redo it. Maybe that's not the right way to do it. So that is a very interactive, a very participatory process. And sometimes it can take time. But once you, as you say, you're a trustworthy agent in that process, whether you're on the leadership or the worker side, then it becomes a collaborative task. And that leads to more trust.
Along this line of trust and safety, we know that many healthcare professionals, including pharmacists, pharmacy technicians, want to seek mental health support, but face barriers in doing so. You mentioned this before, Steph, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about it, but how can we make it safer and less stigmatized for healthcare workers to seek support?
Anna, thank you for asking that question. I really appreciate it. And as I'm answering it, I'm really answering as a healthcare worker myself, who's experienced some of these barriers, as well as hearing from hundreds of other healthcare workers in my leadership role and in my role at the foundation. We know that a primary barrier to help seeking among the healthcare workforce are the worried about judgment and professional repercussions with talking about and seeking mental health care. And these come from different areas. And in the third action in the guide, we really describe how to remove some of these institutional barriers to help seeking, some of which organizations may not even be aware of. And we want to make sure that hospitals can instead provide options for healthcare workers to get mental health care outside of their workplace. They don't need to go to their own colleagues and coworkers for care. And also that they can receive confidential care through an online platform and unaffiliated hospitals, confidential options, and that really they need to share what those options are with staff and reinforce that it's safe to seek mental health care, and that they can reinforce that message that it's safe by looking at the questions that they ask on credentialing applications, the parts of their hospital bylaws around mental health care, any peer reference forms, and look at the licensing in their state and really share with their healthcare workforce what the rules are, where they work, and what questions they're going to be asked. And frankly, if they're asking those questions, they can change them and remove them from their credentialing applications and peer reference forms so that healthcare workers aren't going to be asked about the history of their diagnosis or treatment of mental health care, you know, even when no impairment exists. And these actions send a powerful message to healthcare workers that this is positive, that it's a sign of strength to seek mental health care. And really, that's the vision we have for the future.
Yeah, I just wanted to put big, big, big exclamation points through everything that you just said, Steph. And I wanted to congratulate the foundation for their work in this area. They've been leaders in identifying, as Steph said, a lot of hospital leaders have no idea that these kinds of issues create not only stigma, but the threat of licensure, whether you're a pharmacy licensee, a nursing licensee, a physician licensee, these things can ruin your career. And so the attention that the foundation has drawn to this state by state by state by state has really been remarkable. And in doing that, as Steph you've just said, it really brings hopefully a change to the whole profession. So that, you know, we as professionals frequently advise our patients to seek a psychology, a psychiatry, marriage and family counseling, blah, 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 all of these psychological services. And yet we ourselves are not, we're talking the talk, but we can't do the do because we're afraid. So I just wanted to say the foundation has really led all of us in this area. And that issue of eliminating the stigma and the threat of seeking, self-seeking mental health is extremely important.
Thank you for that, John. And it's great because what we've seen is that with awareness has come change. And so we are seeing a revolution in the way that state licensing agencies are changing the questions. There is real change happening. And I want healthcare workers, right? The pharmacists listening to this podcast, healthcare workers across the country to know that this change has happened and is happening in your organizations. And so, you know, I always say if a tree falls in the woods and nobody hears it, it might not make a sound. If a licensing application changes and the people who are going to be asked those questions don't know it, it doesn't remove the barrier to seek help. And so we also want to make sure that organizations are communicating with their employees, what the rules are, where they work. And so people can feel safe that they're able to seek care without being asked these questions on their applications.
To that point, we've looked at this a little bit from the pharmacy profession because of learning more about this from the Dr. Lorna Green Heroes Foundation and learning from medicine and nursing. And our understanding is that it's not as prevalent in licensing exams as it has been historically in medicine and nursing. But it could be in the employment and the credentialing areas. And so we have more awareness building to do and really glad that we can partner with you specifically on this area. I agree with John that this has been really impactful work.
It's great because, and it's really nice to hear that these questions aren't as prevalent in pharmacy. I think it will be even better when people know that universally, right? Because then the stigma also, it helps to reduce the stigma across the board.
Well, and I also think the scope of practice of pharmacists is increasing all the time. And once you start giving vaccinations and once you start giving heavy advice and once you start handing out the Narcan and all the dispensing becomes a much broader field than it ever has been. And I think that's an important issue. And with broader scope of responsibilities comes sometimes these changes in certification and licensure. And more attention is focused on those issues. So I don't think pharmacists are going to be excused, immune, accepted from the rest of us healthcare workers in terms of these issues of licensure and credentialing and these questions.
Well, thank you for that. That's why we value being considered. Thank you. And to that point, as engaged pharmacists and pharmacy technicians are listening to this, thinking this all sounds great, but how can I be sure that my hospital is really making changes that will support my well-being and improve things in a meaningful way? What can I as an individual do in the meantime?
This has to be a collaborative effort, right? So we know that operational change can't necessarily happen with one individual, but I also understand any individual pharmacist's desire to make sure that real improvements are made and happen. And one thing that any healthcare worker can do is to elevate the guide to be a catalyst for their hospital or their system to really accelerate the well-being efforts, raise awareness to your leadership that the guide exists and can be used both to educate leaders around what they can do to impact the healthcare workforce, but also explain the steps that can be taken and really that there is a stepwise approach that can accelerate the pace of change. And that hearing from their healthcare workforce is one of the things that can help motivate healthcare leaders to start to talk about this work, to use the guide to affect change, and to really sustain that commitment to change over time. It can be so hard to hear every day about the struggles, about the burnout, about the mental health challenges, and not have something to do. It's hard. And we know that healthcare leaders are also experiencing burnout. And so giving people an actionable change that they can make is incredibly helpful. And that's what I would encourage anyone who wants to start to make change to do.
Yeah, I would just again emphasize, Steph, the kind of things that you're saying, elevating the guide you're talking about. Advocate for use of the guide wherever their hospital formulary meeting. Well, bring up the guide. Has everybody read it? Here's a couple copies. Be the person that's out there acting as an advocate for the guide. So it does have some information in it, but don't be shy. Use the guide. Make people read it if they haven't read it already. Other pharmacists that may not in their busy lives have that opportunity, but talk about it with your coworkers. Create a buzz.
That's a great way to think about it from a grassroots advocacy perspective. The next question is to think about how can leaders and advocates get support in their implementation of policies and programs that help employee well-being beyond what we've talked about today? What are other efforts that are worth noting?
Well, the action two that Steph reviewed when she went through all six actions supports leaders building a multidisciplinary professional well-being team. That's really a key at the start. Again, you bring people together for participation. You develop a formalistic structural team so people know that leadership is committed to that. It has a schedule. It meets regularly. It has an agenda. It has discussion points. And only then is it going to be centered within the organization. So as other organizational issues contribute to stress in the workforce, the team building contributes to solutions in the workforce. So it's turning the organizational issue on its head. It's adding to the organization something that's very positive and solutions-based.
And just to piggyback on that, John, the word multidisciplinary can't be said enough. Healthcare is a team sport, and really all of the team members need to be represented in the work to improve the workplace environment. We also know not every health system, hospital, clinic, medical group, right? They're not all alike. And so one of the things that we've developed to help leaders implement the guide in their organizations is a virtual workshop series to do a deeper dive into the actions. so that leaders can ask questions, they can learn from their peers and share feedback on how things are going. There's going to be a three-part series that'll include examples of the actions in practice, so case studies, how it works, when it works, and feature hospital leaders, including those who tested the guide from the Common Spirit Health System. We're looking forward to helping participants adopt the guide in their own settings and develop a community of practice that's really dedicated to this well-being work.
Well, thank you for this wonderful discussion. Excited to see more momentum with the guide and all the support that's being built around it. As we close, I want to ask each of you, what else do you want to share or highlight or reaffirm? Or even what is your hope for this work? And John, why don't we start with you and then have Steph share her thoughts too.
Sure. I think what I would mention at the outset is the guide is a compilation of a lot of different source material, as I mentioned before. And it brings together for the reader and for the hospital leader and the pharmacy leader a lot of information that would take you a lot of time to be able to put together. So I think that's one of the real advantages to the guide actuated and then produces results that we hope you'll tell us about your successes, because that will help others. And I think having some case examples would really be helpful. And I know the foundation is very much in touch with that type of thing. And I look forward to the months and years ahead where we can say, okay, well, here's some case examples. Here's this particular large pharmacy, small pharmacy, mid-sized pharmacy that used the guide, and here's their experience, and let others learn from it. So I think that's really important. And I wanted to thank you, Anna, and the organization for having this podcast and allowing us to get the message out to pharmacists, because they, like frontline nurses and doctors, respiratory therapists, and others that work in a healthcare system, are just vital, critical links in helping us all be healthier Americans. So thank you, Anna.
Absolutely. I want to echo John's thanks and pause for a moment to recognize that every healthcare worker has made a decision to commit their time and their talents and their livelihood to caring for others. Hard stop. And ultimately, my goal for this work is that every hospital, every care setting in the U.S. has the tools to make meaningful operational changes so that the people who have made that choice, who deserve these changes, have the opportunity to work in a safe and healthy workplace. Ultimately, that's the goal. And so I want to thank you as well for helping us bring this message.
Well, it's been wonderful to hear and learn from both of you today. That's all the time we have. I want to sincerely thank Dr. Don Howard, Dr. Stephanie Simmons for joining us today to talk about pharmacy workforce, occupational well-being, burnout, and systems level solutions. If you hadn't had a chance, I encourage you to visit wellbeing.ashp.org, where you can learn more about our resources, our partnership with organizations that have been a guiding light to a lot of our work, and other tools to support your individual and organizational well-being. Please be sure to join us here each month for more on well-being and resilience.
Thank you for listening to ASHP Official, the voice of pharmacists advancing healthcare. Be sure to visit ashp.org/podcast to discover more great episodes, access show notes, and download the episode transcript. If you loved the episode and want to hear more, be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave a review. Join us next time on ASHP Official.